It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The fourth path of the Buddha's Eightfold Path to liberation from suffering is right action. And right action stems from right view, which we talked about that's the first path. And the story of the murderer, Angulimala, clearly demonstrates this being right action stems from right view. So I'm going to read you the story of Angulimala as told by Thich Nhat Hanh. One morning when the Buddha entered Savatthi, it seemed like a ghost town. All doors were bolted shut. No one was on the streets. The Buddha stood in front of a home where he normally received food offerings. The door opened a crack, and seeing it was the Buddha, the owner hastily ran out and invited him to enter. Once inside, the owner latched the door and invited the Buddha to sit. He suggested the Buddha remained to eat his meal inside the house. He said, "Lord, it is very dangerous to go outside today. The murderer Angulimala has been seen in these parts. They say he has killed many people in other cities. Every time he kills someone, he cuts off one of their fingers and adds it to a string he wears around his neck. They say that once he has killed 100 people and has a talisman of 100 fingers hanging around his neck, he will gain even more terrible evil powers. It is strange. He never steals anything from the people he murders. King Pasenadi has organized a brigade of soldiers and police to hunt him down." The Buddha asked, "Why must the king enlist the aid of an entire brigade of soldiers to hunt down just one man?" "Respected Gotama, Angulimala is very dangerous. He possesses phenomenal fighting skills. Once he overcame 40 men who surrounded him on the street. He killed most of them. The survivors had to flee for their lives. Angulimala is said to hide out in Jalini Forest. No one dares passes by there anymore. Not long ago, 20 armed police entered the forest to try to capture him. Only 2 came out alive. Now that Angulimala has been spotted in the city, no one dares to go out to work or shop." The Buddha thanked the man for telling him about Angulimala and then stood up to take his leave. The man implored the Buddha to remain safely inside, but the Buddha refused. He said that he could only preserve the trust of the people by continuing to do his begging as usual. As the Buddha walked slowly and mindfully down the street, he suddenly heard the sound of steps running behind him in the distance. He knew it was Angulimala, but he felt no fear. He continued to take slow steps, aware of everything taking place within and outside of himself. Angulimala shouted, "Stop, monk, stop!" The Buddha continued taking slow, stable steps. He knew from the sound of Angulimala's footsteps that he had slowed down to a brisk walk and was not far behind. Although the Buddha was now 56 years old, his sight and hearing were keener than ever. He knew nothing. He held nothing but his begging bowl. He smiled as he recollected how quick and agile he had been in martial arts as a young prince. The other young men were never able to deliver him a blow. The Buddha knew that Angulimala was very close now and was surely carrying a weapon. The Buddha continued to walk with ease. When Angulimala caught up to the Buddha, he walked alongside him and said, "I told you to stop, monk. Why don't you stop?" The Buddha continued to walk as he said, "Angulimala, I stopped a long time ago. It is you who have not stopped." Angulimala was startled by the Buddha's unusual reply. He blocked the Buddha's path, forced the Buddha to stop. The Buddha looked into Angulimala's eyes. Again, Angulimala was startled. The Buddha's eyes shone like two stars. Angulimala had never encountered someone who radiated such serenity and ease. Everyone else always ran away from him in terror. Why didn't this monk show any fear? The Buddha was looking at him as if he were a friend or brother. The Buddha had said Angulimala's name, so it was clear that he knew who Angulimala was. Surely he knew about his treacherous deeds. How could he remain so calm and relaxed when faced with a murderer? Suddenly, Angulimala felt he could no longer bear the Buddha's kind and gentle gaze. He said, "Monk, you said you stopped a long time ago, but you were still walking. You said I was the one who was not stopped. What did you mean by that?" The Buddha replied, "Angulimala, I stopped committing acts that cause suffering to other living beings a long time ago. I have learned to protect life, the lives of all beings, not just humans. Angulimala, all living beings want to live. All fear death. We must nurture a heart of compassion and protect the lives of all beings. Human beings do not love each other. Why should I love other people? Humans are cruel and deceptive. I will not rest until I have killed them all." The Buddha spoke gently. "Angulimala, I know you have suffered deeply at the hands of other humans. Sometimes humans can be cruel. Such cruelty is the result of ignorance, hatred, desire, and jealousy. But humans can also be understanding and compassionate. Have you ever met a bhikkhu before? Bhikkhus vow to protect the lives of all other beings. They vow to overcome desire, hatred, and ignorance. There are many people, not just bhikkhus, whose lives are based in understanding and love. Angulimala, there may be cruel people in this world, but there are also many kind people. Do not be blinded. My path can transform cruelty into kindness. Hatred is the path you are on now. You should stop. Choose the path of forgiveness, understanding, and love instead." Angulimala was moved by the monk's words, yet his mind was thrown into confusion as well, and suddenly he felt as if he had been cut open and salt thrown on the open wound. He could see that the Buddha spoke from love. There was no hatred in the Buddha, no aversion. The monk looked at Angulimala as if he considered him a whole person worthy of respect. Could this monk be the very Gotama he had heard people praise, the one they called the Buddha? Buddha means awakened one. Angulimala asked, "Are you the monk Gotama?" The Buddha nodded. Angulimala said, "It is a great pity I did not meet you sooner. I have gone too far already on my path of destruction. It is no longer possible to turn back." The Buddha said, "No, Angulimala, it is never too late to do a good act." "What good act could I possibly do?" "Stop traveling the road of hatred and violence. That would be the greatest act of all. Angulimala, though the sea of suffering is immense, look back and you will see the shore." "Gotama, even if I wanted to, I could not turn back now. No one would let me live in peace after all I have done." The Buddha grasped Angulimala's hand and said, "Angulimala, I will protect you. If you vow to abandon your mind of hatred and devote yourself to the study and practice of the way, take the vow to begin anew and serve others. It is easy to see you are a man of intelligence. I have no doubt you could succeed on the path of realization." Angulimala knelt before the Buddha. He removed the sword strapped to his back, placed it on the earth, and prostrated himself at the Buddha's feet. He covered his face in his hands and began to sob. After a long time, he looked up and said, "I vow to abandon my evil ways. I will follow you and learn compassion from you. I beg you to accept me as your disciple." At that moment, Venerables Shariputra, Ananda, Upali, Kimbila, and several other bhikkhus arrived on the scene. They surrounded the Buddha and Angulimala. Seeing the Buddha safe and Angulimala preparing to take the refuges, their hearts rejoiced. The Buddha asked Ananda to give him an extra set of robes. He told Shariputra to ask the next house if they could borrow a razor for Upali to shave Angulimala's head. Angulimala was ordained right there and then. He knelt down, recited the three refuges, and was given the precepts by Upali. Afterwards, they returned to Jetavana together. Over the next 10 days, Upali and Shariputra taught Angulimala about the practice of the precepts, the practice of meditation, and the way of begging. Angulimala made a greater effort than any other bhikkhu before him. Even the Buddha was astonished at his transformation when he visited Angulimala 2 weeks after his ordination. Angulimala radiated serenity and stability and so rare a gentleness that the other bhikkhus called him Ahimsaka, which means nonviolent one. It had, in fact, been his name at birth. So that's a touching story. Angulimala ended up being one of the Buddha's 10 foremost disciples when he was on the track of hatred with a view to killing everyone. His life consisted of murdering. But when he met the Buddha and came on the path of Dharma, he excelled in gentleness. So the whole point of reading you that story was to demonstrate that right action stems from right view. If you see hatred, your actions will reflect hatred. If you see Dharma, your actions will reflect a mind filled with Dharma. So how do we make the shift? We are not murderers, but we still don't know exactly what we're doing. How do we find out? Zen Buddhist priest Shodo Spring tells us how she first came to some understanding. And this is also another sweet story. Not, not exactly like Angulimala's, but so Shodo Spring is saying, it was my first sesshin. Innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. A one-day retreat, and I encountered the meal chant for the first time. As we receive this offering, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. During the break, I grabbed a chant book and started to memorize, fully aware of the no reading rules. And this is the meal chant that she memorized. As we desire the natural condition of mind to be free from clinging, we must be free from greed. To support our life, we take this food. To attain the Buddha way, we take this food. This food is for the three treasures, for our parents, teachers, leaders, and homeland, and for all beings in the six worlds. Thus, we eat this food with everyone. We eat to end all evil, to practice good, to save all sentient beings, and to accomplish the Buddha way. This old translation spoke to me so deeply, uncorrected, naming our place within the whole cycle of things. Innumerable labors. Not only the cook, the kitchen helper, the grocery store clerk, truck drivers, and farm workers, but the plants, the soil microbes and fungi, worms and beetles, compost and manure, weeds that bring the minerals up from the depths, wind and rain and sun, a whole world of beings works and plays together and somehow comes to me through the food that grows thus. Even if I grow my own food as I do, this is Shodo Spring talking, if I compost local plant and animal manures, terrace the garden so it holds the water straight from the sky, plant every seed with my own hands, say a blessing over each one, watch it and weed it, mulch it and tend it, and then harvest clean and prepare it with great effort, even then, the innumerable labors are way beyond this individual self. Life is a gift. Whether our virtue and practice deserve it, there is no such thing as deserving this gift. To be alive is a gift, freely given by the world around us, which does not judge or censure us. How does one live? What response can possibly be appropriate for a gift of such magnitude? And she goes on, we receive food for all beings with no exceptions, and thus we also receive food along with everyone. We are a part of this crowd of life. Our intention is to end all evil, to practice good, to free beings, and to accomplish the way. And right action is like this. It arises simply and directly from understanding our place in the world, the understanding that we call right view. When there is nothing but the gift, what can there be but gratitude? When there is nothing but gratitude, what arises will naturally be what we call right action. There is no need for control or even a decision on our part. And because we are a part of the whole throng of living beings, right action is on behalf of those beings and on behalf of the way that sustains us. So this idea of there's no need even for control or a decision on our part. If we have out of gratitude, right action arises naturally. And so it's kind of like we don't even need to do anything. Just be mindful of our actions and our what we do in our life. The line that grabbed her heart also grabbed mine. This innumerable labors, this line, innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. And also receiving this offering, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. I've chanted that for years and years. And it every single time, I always felt stopped by it. So this idea, though, of knowing how it comes to us is so vast. And then she connects it with right action. It arises simply and directly from understanding our place in the world and that life is a gift. And as to whether virtue and practice deserve it, there is no such thing. To be alive is a gift freely given by the world around us, which does not judge or censure us. And so how does one live when there is nothing but the gift? What can there be but gratitude? And when there's nothing but gratitude, what arises will naturally be right action. It does make sense. So what is this gift? When you have never thought of your, you may never thought of your life as a gift, but it means, so in Buddhism, it means that everything is the result of causes and conditions, and our life is no exception. So we ourselves didn't make our life. It comes to us or simply arose out of the endless masses of interconnected causes and conditions. This is the Buddhist perspective. Our life, we didn't make our life, and it comes to us out of the endless masses of interconnected causes and conditions. More specifically, right action, it is said, stems from three things. First, the Buddha's compassion. Second, right view, which we've already mentioned. And third, the Dharma, the teachings. So regarding Buddha's compassion, Katagiri Roshi wrote something about this. It's very lovely. All sentient beings are allowed to live and are, from the beginning, forgiven for living their lives in this world. Everything, whatever it is, has some reason why it exists. Evil, good, even something neither evil nor good. You cannot destroy devils just because you don't like them. Even though you don't like monsters, still there is some reason why they exist. Everything is entitled to live in this world in peace and harmony beyond our judgment, our evaluation. This is the first condition we have to realize. Everything is Buddha. I think that's a hard one, actually. Not that everything is Buddha, but remembering that we can't destroy devils just because we don't like them. So Katagiri continues. Remember, I just want to remind you, Katagiri is the one who said a few Dharma talks ago, there was a woman whose first dokusan with Katagiri Roshi, the only thing he said to her after her elaborate sitting down was, you can't avoid pain. And then he rang the bell for her to leave. That was all he said. So, I mean, he has this, you can't destroy devils just because you don't like them, you know, end of story. And you can't avoid pain, end of story. But here he continues for covering the second condition of right action. So there's the Buddha's compassion, which we just said, and then there's right view is the self, that the self must readily accept the condition. So there's Buddha's compassion, and then there's we need to accept the Buddha's compassion. We must actualize the Buddha's compassion in our everyday lives. We have to live our lives in the complete realization that we are already forgiven, that we are already allowed to live, and we ourselves must make our lives come alive. A lot of people don't realize this. We ourselves must make our life come alive. Our lives do not take place in the idea of the world or in the idea of ourselves. They occur in the middle of the Buddha's compassion. And to be alive, we must completely realize that compassion. We create our own lives. We make ourselves live in the middle of a dynamic universe. The life of practice is not passive. It acts. It takes initiative. It reaches out to embrace the universe. The shape of that embrace is not prescribed, but embracing the universe is the nature of right action. And then regarding the third condition, the Dharma, the teachings, you know, Buddhism is full of teachings, as you know. So here's a couple though, that just to remind you. And the first is one that we talked about last week, the Shishobo in Japanese, or the Bodhisattva's four embracing Dharmas. If you feel confused by all these talks and how can you remember everything and I don't even know where to start, here's a good one. This is a really good one. If you recall, Dogen was the first person to see this teaching in all of the Buddha's sutras. No one taught the Bodhisattva's four embracing dharmas before Dogen. So Dogen was like 13th century AD, and the Buddha was 2,500 years ago. So a lot of time passed before Dogen noticed this teaching, and he picked it out, and the Bodhisattva's four embracing dharmas are giving, generosity, giving, endearing speech, which is why we talked about it last week, beneficent conduct, that is helpful conduct, and impartiality. So giving, endearing speech, beneficent conduct, and impartiality. The thing that's neat about Buddhism is that you can take a practice like this, hand-plucked from the Buddha's teachings by Dogen, and organize the rest of your life around it. You know, my practice is the Bodhisattva's four embracing dharmas. And there you go, that's all you need. You know, honestly, that's all you need. You can listen to all the rest of it, and you can take it in, sort of, or apply it to your practice of the Bodhisattva's four embracing dharmas. But your practice is giving, endearing speech, beneficent conduct, and impartiality. Of it all, the impartiality might be the hardest. It means non-discrimination. And non-discrimination means, actually, the truth is, it means non-duality. So there's no good and evil, there's no good and bad, there's no right and wrong, there's no I like her but I don't like her. It's impartiality, so non-discrimination. That's probably the hardest one of the four, but you could take these four and that's all. That's your entire Buddhist practice. And beneficent conduct would probably involve some kind of meditation practice, ideally Zazen, because it's the most encompassing. Okay, so that's that. So, okay, the Bodhisattva's four embracing dharmas, that's one teaching that leads to right action. And the three pure precepts, we learned about these in the series on the precepts, but we hear them all the time, to avoid all evil, to cultivate good, and to, I'm going to say, cleanse one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. The cultivating good and avoiding evil can be defined in the ordinary way, but cleansing one's mind does not mean to think only positive and kind thoughts, nor does it have other ordinary meanings. But instead, it is Katagiri's first condition to realize that everything is Buddha. It means to refrain from dualism. Without thoughts of good and evil, how does right action arise? But without imagining evil, how can we avoid it? So to avoid evil and practice good and realize that everything is Buddha, that's that teaching. So that's the second way, the second teaching that you can use to actualize right action. There's another teaching called the three minds. This is how Buddhism is. It's always has a number attached. Joyful mind, magnanimous mind, and nurturing mind. This is another teaching you could take on. Joyful mind, magnanimous mind, and nurturing mind. Joyful mind and magnanimous mind are pretty clear, but nurturing mind is literally old woman mind. It's like the heart and mind of a grandmother. The grandmothers love her grandchildren extending everywhere. The archetype of a grandmother is unconditional love, inspiring respect, offering wisdom, and most of all, kindness with loving presence. So that's another practice that you can take on and run with it and forget everything else. So, I mean, basically be supported by everything else, but this is my practice: joyful mind, magnanimous mind, and nurturing mind. And then we've had this one a long time, an appropriate response. There was, this was in a koan when Zen master Yunmen was asked, what are the teachings of a whole lifetime? And Yunmen answered, an appropriate response. When suffering arises, we always have to decide what to do, or rather we have to get out of the way and let the appropriate action arise. But usually we call that deciding. So to get to an appropriate response, we get out of the way. We get our ego out of the way and we let an appropriate response arise. That's how to get an appropriate response. So that's another practice. And finally, Thich Nhat Hanh's love in action. I love that phrase, love in action. The nature of the struggle is not a doctrine. This is Thich Nhat Hanh now. The nature of the struggle is not a doctrine to be materialized by a program of action. It is communication and love. Thus, its leaders must create and inspire love for the masses in the hearts of the people. So he says its leaders need to create and inspire love. They touch, the leaders touch the people by altruistic acts born from their own love. When Na Chi Mai burned herself because she wanted to be a, quote, torch in the dark night, she moved millions of Vietnamese. The force she engendered was the force of love for nonviolent action. Shodo Spring concludes, as Katagiri Roshi said, everything is Buddha. In the ground of the Buddha's compassion, the whole world arises. Receiving the Buddha's compassion, acknowledging ourselves to be forgiven, and allowing ourselves to be exactly who we are, we come to realize ever more deeply how we belong to this world. The entire world, without exception, is the true human body because of interconnectedness. As Dogen said, and if we allow ourselves to meet it, we are verified by all things. So the entire world, without exception, is really the true human body. And if we allow ourselves to meet it, we are verified by all things. Here are some of the most important points from today's talk. First, the life of practice is not passive. It acts. It takes initiative. It reaches out to embrace the universe. Second, we have to live our lives in the complete realization that we are already forgiven, that we are already allowed to live, and that we ourselves must make our lives come alive. Third, Thich Nhat Hanh's love in action. The nature of the struggle is not a doctrine to be materialized by a program. It is communication and love. Fourth, when there is nothing but the gift, what can there be but gratitude? When there's nothing but gratitude, what arises will naturally be what we call right action. There is no need for control or even a decision on our part. Basically, if we hold the correct state of mind, a gratitude state of mind, right action just happens. And also fifth, the beginning of the Zen meal chant. Innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. As we receive this offering, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. And sixth, everything is Buddha, everything has Buddha nature. That's one. And finally, the entire world without exception really is the true human body, as Dogen said. And if we allow ourselves to meet it, we are verified by all beings. And some points for reflection during the week. First, this point, the life of practice is not passive, it acts, it takes initiative, it reaches out to embrace the universe. What does this embrace of the universe look like in your life? Don't forget, everything is the universe, but it would be things that you practice are studied with passion. So what things do you practice or study with passion, which would be acting and taking initiative and embracing the universe? And second, Thich Nhat Hanh's love in action. What does love in action look like in your life today or in the past or in your plans for the future? Can you ground that idea of love in action in your own life? And third, of the three minds, joyful mind, magnanimous mind, and nurturing mind, this nurturing mind, this kind of old woman mind, which boils down to just offering kindness with loving presence. Reflecting on your life, where does this mind appear? Or where might it appear? Or where has it already appeared but disappeared? Think about this particular mind of kindness with loving presence and see if you can pin it down in yourself. And the fourth idea for this week is the words of the Zen meal chant. I think you can look, if you don't catch them, you can probably Google them, frankly. But the words of the Zen meal chant, or any meal chant at all that you have, that you know or love. Experiment with using a meal chant before meals and see what happens. Just try it. It changes things, I think. And this, the last one, right action stems from right view. And so what is your view? Can you give an example of how your actions stem from your view? And if you have difficulty, you may think, it may help to think of either positively or negatively. It might help to think of the view of your parents and how their actions stemmed from this view. Sometimes you go, well, I don't even know what my view is. But if you think of someone else and what their view is and how their actions stem from it, you can go back and say, oh, I see. Well, my view is such and such. So that's all those five things. But again, these points for reflection, which I'm now posting on the website, are ways for you to take everything from today and just apply it to your own daily life. And that will help you so much to integrate this particular talk and each and every talk. That's why I'm offering them. I really encourage you to use those questions. In fact, I even encourage you to do what that one student is doing, making a file on your computer of all of the questions, starting from I think it was the third talk in the second series, and answering them, not just making a list. Okay. Well, I wonder if you have any questions.
Thank you, Kegel. So there is a first comment that we got, and it starts with something quoted from today's talk. Human beings do not love each other. Why should I love other people? Humans are cruel and deceptive. I will not rest until I've killed them all. Ungulimala's feelings are more extreme than what I've wished. But when one sees ignorance, selfishness, egotism, and sheer desire for power taking over our world, it's hard to feel love.
So start with yourself. Study yourself. Really, all of Buddhism is about studying yourself. Those feelings may be there, but underneath there is fear, and underneath that there's sadness, and there may be some other things too. Try to identify and get to know all of those things in yourself. And remember Reb's definition of compassion, which is stay close and do nothing. So it would be stay close to yourself. But you need to know what you're staying close to. What is yourself that you're staying close to? Stay close and do nothing. So when you study yourself, stay close to yourself and do nothing. Just notice. And once you do, it's easier to have compassion for yourself. And then from there, compassion for others. I think, however, the Angulimala story is so, it's terrible to say, but I think we all can relate to that feeling of let's just kill everyone. I think there's more to it. There's more to that feeling. That's all.
So the next one that we have is, the life of practice is not passive. It acts, it takes initiative. For me, it's not that I am passive exactly, but there's inertia. Passive seems mental. This inertia feels physical, like my body just won't move. When that happens, I waste a lot of time and feel terrible about myself.
You know, it sounds to me like your inertia is more psychological and emotional And which means that you haven't figured out the most important things for yourself. What is the most important thing in my life? And to organize your life around that thing, like the purpose of your life. When we know that the purpose of my life, it's a big question, but we all need to answer that. The sooner we answer it, the better, because the sooner we answer it, the more we can organize our life around it. And when we're clear, we feel energized. There's not inertia. When we're clear, we can hardly wait. That's more the feeling. So clarity about what am I doing here? What am I doing here? Getting clear about that, really clear, and then organizing every minute of your day in one way or another. I mean, even like taking care of your body, I need my body in order to do this thing, so I'm going to take really good care of it. Or I need my body to do this other thing. And it's going to take all of me to do that thing. So I'm going to take extra good care of myself. Like, it's like that. So first of all, stop. Just stop. And really, really get in touch with what it is. Who is the real you? What is it that you really want to do? What is it that you really want to do? And from there, but you have to be quiet. You have to really, really get in touch with it, because it is there. It's definitely there. We all have what it is that our life is about. Actually, your inertia could be a gift, that it propels you toward answering a question like this, to get your life on the right track. It is, I mean, action in general isn't any better than non-action in general. It's action in specific to satisfy and realize who you are. Like that. That's all.
Thank you, Gil. So the next one that we have is, when it's said that all sentient beings are allowed to live and are from the beginning forgiven for living their lives in this world, why do we need to be forgiven for living our life in this world? We didn't do anything.
I know. You know, I think this is a really important question, and I think that if all goes the way I'm hoping it will go, I hope that the next series after this series will be addressing this question, basically, which is, there's a difference between living by vow and living by karma. And when one takes vows of any kind, and especially Buddhist vows or monastic vows, bodhisattva vows, we talked about those, the precepts, one's life is lived by vow. But before you do that, your life is lived by karma. And the karma is the result of previous actions in this lifetime and previous lifetimes. This is the Buddhist understanding. So the Buddhist understanding is, when there's an effect, there's a cause. So And Dogen has made it clear that obstacles on the spiritual path are the effect that's caused by previous karma. If we have obstacles on the spiritual path, which I know I certainly have, huge ones I have had, I pin it to previous bad karma that I have myself created, and myself in conjunction with the interconnected web of all beings has created this karma for me. And the best you can do is to lay down good causes so that you're clean, and good causes so that your future will be easier. But in a large way, this is why you have your life, liberation. This is exactly why we're here, for liberation. So we're here to clean up our karma. I mean, but that's one way of putting it, honestly. For me, this is one of the most significant teachings in all of Buddhism. I guess that's because it makes sense out of everything. For me, it makes sense out of everything. People balk at the idea of previous lifetimes, but for me, it was a huge relief of, things fall into place then and make sense. That's just how I took it. But anyway, I hope that answers your question. There's a difference between, so when you say we haven't done anything, we actually have done quite a bit, unfortunately. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So we have like 2 minutes left. Should I ask the last question that we have?
If it's a short one, yes.
So we have one that, can you explain that, what does this mean that our lives do not take place in our idea of the world or in our idea of ourselves? They occur in the middle of the Buddha's compassion, and to be alive, we must completely realize that compassion.
So, our view of our lives normally, this is why that talk on right view was so important, and it's important even today on the talk of right action, because our view of our lives is extremely smaller than how things actually exist. And how things actually exist, honestly, it's God is love is a really good one. I mean, that it encompasses the vastness of how things actually exist. And so one Roshi, Uchiyama Roshi, has this phrase, opening the hand of thought. Opening the hand of thought. And that action and idea begins to encompass the vastness of realizing Buddha's compassion. Zazen is the best activity for that. You sit with that, and this understanding arises. So I know we're out of time, and before I close, I want to thank Sahar and Brian and Brendan for all of the work that they do for making this possible. And I hope I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.